you know, as soon as it starts to feel less enjoyable, which isn't the intention when you create a company, right? You want to create this great environment with people you vibe, and there's, you know, this excitement that is contagious, and everybody just want to come together and solve a problem. That's the most rewarding part of being part of the startup world. Mm-hmm. As soon as it starts to feel a little bit off and not enjoyable anymore, that's the first answer you have and the first sign you have that something needs to be done.
Welcome to the Alchemist Lounge. What if you could hang out with high-performing executives, entrepreneurs, and leaders? Ask them about how psychedelics have impacted their self-improvement journeys. Then take an insight or two to guide your own growth. Each week, Alex Atwood takes an in-depth look at how psychedelics can increase fulfillment, solve personal problems affecting your career, and help you gain the success you seek. Alex is an executive and psychedelics coach to high performers, and his goal is to provide strategies to help you reduce conflict, bring awareness, and balance your life through the use of psychedelics. Now, here's Alex.
Welcome to another episode of the Alchemist Lounge. Today in the lounge, we're going to be talking all about startups, specifically company culture when it comes to startups, and we have an expert in the field. Her name is Sophie Thien. She's literally wrote the book called The Soul of Startups. And there's so much alchemy in a startup. I've learned all about that by running a startup. So I'm super excited to talk to Sophie today. And here she is. So I run a startup, and this is the Alchemist Lounge. And one thing I know is that building company culture and really looking at the soul of an organization, there's a lot of alchemy there in building those relationships and putting that together and kind of making that work. So we're going to dig into culture. We're going to dig into what it looks like to build a culture in your startup on today's show. Let's start here. So I was going through your bio, and you mentioned that there's an approach to going from me to we. And I love that. So tell me a little bit about what it takes to transform an organization from me to we.
Yes. So for going from a startup from me to we is really about finally having a founder who understands that you're no longer creating a business just for yourself. This business is going to feed so many people. Your product's going to go out to so many different customers and into the customer's hands. You are now creating a sustainable and hopefully a good working environment for everybody in the company, be it it's 2 people, 4 people, 10, or 1,000. I think the mentality change here is that you're now also a manager as well as a leader of the company. And I think a lot of founders forget that being a leader is equally also, if not more important, than becoming just a great manager. We tend to have this excuse for founders where we go, oh, you know what? They're serial entrepreneurs, or they're entrepreneurs, and so therefore they can kind of get away from not being a great manager. But at the end of the day, no matter what, we all need to be a great manager for the company to be successful. So I think this is, you know, one of the main things I would say to absolutely nail and be an expert in before you go from me to we.
Mm. So what to you is the difference between a manager and a leader?
So for me, great question as always. So for me, being a great manager means you've got to be really, really good in your communication. You've got to be very cognitive of the different kind of people, personalities, behaviors that you're going to be working with. So someone who is, you know, has a touch and feel of the people that they're working with, be it like giving directions on a daily basis, doing effective one-to-ones, asking for feedback, giving feedback, right? And just taking people through a journey and giving them clear directions so that they know exactly what to do in their day-to-day as they wake up in the morning and trying to kill it for your company. On the other hand, leadership simply just means you should have an answer to most of the problems. Let's be honest. Right? You're going to take charge, bring the company together with you. And if there's going to be a challenge, you're the first one to stand up and go, it's okay, we've got this, but let me get this through first. Or like, you know, start to show a little bit more vulnerability, have more honest conversations with your employees, and just show that if it's a bad time in the market, for example, there's no point sugarcoating that you're the only company exclusively in the world that's not suffering from it, right? We all know that There's macro, micro, right? Exactly. And so I think being a leader means being able to show vulnerability. And I love this when I do my coaching in leadership, is being able to show vulnerability, not as a sign of weakness, but show it in the right place and also to the right people. And I think the right audiences is actually going to turn it into an advantage. So that's the difference I see between a manager and a leader.
And so with what it sounds like is, as a leader, you're building real relationships in that vulnerability. You're actually showing humanity there in both you, and hopefully that opens up in the organization. Does that sound right?
Yeah, absolutely. And being a manager simply just means, you know, the very definition of being a manager is to manage those day-to-day operationally. So I think this is where people kind of get confused. Am I a leader or am I a manager? No, actually, you should be both.
What does it take to be able to have both of those qualities? So as a startup founder myself and working in lots of startup circles, I find a lot of founders are there in that position where they have to manage the day-to-day operation, make sure the engine is running. And at the same time, they have to put leadership in there. And a lot of times, based on your definition of leadership, right? And a lot of times, founders may feel as though that vulnerability may be weakness, or it may, you know, it may kind of show holes in the foundation of the company. So what do you say to that?
Yeah, for sure. I get this question a lot. And this is what I do in my coaching, which is to really kind of, you know, take that misperception away and get founders into a much more comfortable position to also feel really confident that showing vulnerability is a sign of strength, where it makes you really open up and connect to your people more emotionally. Now, let's not use this word emotional as if it's a taboo. We all have feelings. We're all made of flesh and blood. There's no different, right? Yep. And I think this is the main thing. I think there is a lot of misperception out there where we perceive and we expect leaders or entrepreneurs or founders per se, that they're this unbreakable, you know, figure. There's just all superhero and all superpower. There's no weakness. And all they've got to do is just carry this whole world on the back of their shoulders. But why should it be that way? They're human. They're trying their best to be a manager. And the difference between, you know, managing operationally as a manager is you've got processes out there, right? People have built great processes. You don't have to go and reinvent the wheel anymore. There's like management books and there's like, you know, robust processes that other experts have already proven. So just apply it into your day-to-day, you know, get a template, get a form, whatever it is that works for you, and help you start practicing great one-to-ones, which starts from asking great questions and then start practicing a lot more of your active listening. But then on the other hand, as leadership, it should really just fit like a glove for you. You know, you're building out these great relationships. So it's almost like what you put out there should be what you're trying to also expect to receive. So how would you treat people the way that you want yourself to be treated in whatever circumstances or situation? And this is what makes this distinctive difference between a manager and a leader. And I hope that founders really understand that. Unfortunately, it's one of those roles where they need to master both. Right? There's no, you know, there's no like pick one lane and be great at one and not the other. It's one of those roles that you absolutely need to master both, but there's a way around it. It's not, you know, it's not like there's no resources.
Yeah. It sounds like maybe something around empathetic management or compassionate management, where you're managing and in the managing, you're being vulnerable. You know, vulnerability is something that I've spoken with people quite often about now, and just how strong of a bond it really does build, and how relationships just get so deep and they're nourished through vulnerability. So now I'm starting to understand where the terminology foundation fixer came in for you, right? Because this is truly foundational in an organization. Is that where that term came from? Because of the fact that you kind of see where vulnerability and leadership may not be present and you can kind of plug that in?
Absolutely. And I think it also really fits into, like, for so many years, I've been operating in a people leadership role. And that means I've got, you know, front seats to watch how founders are trying to react to behaviors all at the same time. Like I said, it's a really tough job for them to kind of carry the entire company on their backs and still make good, right? They need to look good from an optical point of view. They need to show to the investors or the board that, you know, you're investing in the right company and the right leader, all at the same time trying to manage every single thing from A to Z. Most of the time, especially in an early stage, they're ultimately the decision maker all the way from, you know, is this the right sandwich to buy for a social party, all the way until is this the right office location for us because it's commutable. So yeah. I think all in all, it's when I've had that privilege to be in the front seat, I've finally truly kind of like, for me, I cracked the code and really understood that to do a people role well, it isn't about me taking on this responsibility all by myself. For example, thinking that as a people leader, it is fully my responsibility to fix a culture, or if not to build a great culture. I finally, you know, came to a point where I understood I need to work with the founders in tandem. And how can I work with them in tandem is we need to be able to coach each other. So it's almost like we're doing a peer coaching with each other where I go, right, what are your gaps? What are your strengths? Let's fit it into each other and let's make it compatible so that I can fill some of those gaps when you don't have the time to do so. I can look after the people, but let's be honest, as much as I want to look after the people, you still need to very much be the figure person. So I think without working in tandem this way, it would have probably never been possible. So then it goes back to, these are the foundations that we need to create great sustainable businesses, because the founders then at the top of the pyramid needs to fully understand that running a business is as simple as treating the people right.
That's exactly right. So let me, I looked up your background and I see you have a degree in mechanical engineering, which is fascinating to me. And so then I started to think, okay, so now we have someone who is clearly, you know, an expert in the HR realm, specifically around cultural aspects and building. I want to understand your journey. So what had you get a mechanical engineering degree? And then where did you start to see that maybe that would translate into what you're doing today?
A little bit of sheer luck, to be honest. I would say about 50% of it is I kind of fell into the role, started doing recruitment, and I realized that I have a knack for like building relationships with that, which I really, really, truly enjoyed. And that was one of the elements that was missing being an engineer, because I wasn't close enough with people other than the team that I was with. Together, we're problem solving. There's a lot of creativity going on. But for me, it just kind of didn't feel like that was enough. I felt like maybe I could do something with a bigger impact. So I kind of landed into one thing after another, into such a deeply rooted people and culture role, especially in a startup. And I've just never looked back since. And I think a lot of the work that I do, for example, because you don't see it right now, but if you were to sit right next to me and have worked with me for over like 2 weeks, you will find how meticulous I am. Everything needs to be in a diagram. And I think this is the engineer in me that's kind of like oozing out, can be sometimes, you know, overpowering, where they go, well, isn't people and culture supposed to be like all hand-holding and conversational? But why do you have so much data and metrics? But at the same time, this is also when I'm like, yes, it needs to be. You need to be fully vulnerable to do a people leader role. But at the same time, I also feel like I need to be making very good data-driven decisions, because we need to be able to take the emotional, you know, part out of this equation so that we can all move forward and make the right decisions, which I know it sounds a little bit like an irony, but I don't think I would have enjoyed the people role this much if I didn't have the kind of right environment or the space or the opportunity to kind of add my kind of like past life, you know, my previous life into like the equation and dynamic of how or what I do in the startups now.
Yeah. Well, let's dig into that a bit, because I know you you migrated to Australia at a young age. I'd like to hear about where you grew up. You know, what had this show up? How did you create this balance between, you know, engineering and human resources and relationships? Did anything growing up in maybe Australia or before that impact that?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm Chinese. And so as you can imagine, Asian families are large. They are not very affectionate people, which kind of, you know, migrating to a slightly different country and growing up in a different culture has taught me that maybe being a little bit more affectionate can actually build better relationships, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I'm just going to put it out there. This is something that I talk to my mom a lot. But I felt really privileged having grown up in like, you know, two different kind of spectrums of this kind of relationship building. And when I went into a startup, it just kind of, you know, when you go into a startup and everybody's just like, oh, it's all engineering because we go into tech. And, you know, engineers are deeply rooted into the way they think. It's very hardwired. So there's a lot of like buzzwords going out there where, you know, you would hear people say, oh, it's really cutthroat. And I've operated, you know, 5-6 years in financial services. So you can imagine like how much more cutthroat that is. But deeply inside, you would just realize people are all people. They're exactly the same regardless what industry they're in. And this is where I really, truly then found my passion. And I kind of feel like I found my true calling doing people, culture, and then leadership coaching. It just kind of slowly blended in where I feel, you know what? If I can change from someone who is completely not affectionate because that was what I was brought up with into someone who I think I'm a pretty good coach now. I want to say that to someone who can actually build relationships with like just the randomest strangers in the world, then I think anybody can be changed. And that's like so intriguing for me when I do it, so rewarding for me when I do founder coaching, because I know it's never truly too late. Mm. Like there's a way around this.
Mm, absolutely. And coming from a culture where it's that way of being isn't necessarily a part of the culture, that gives you that perspective to be able to see the impact of it almost as an observer to say, huh, I see how that works. That's fascinating. What was the first startup that you worked for that really sort of got you sparked the current passion around startups?
This was all the way back very quickly after I graduated. So financial crisis hit, couldn't find a job as an engineer. That was so limited work in Australia. And I landed into a startup. I didn't even know the word startup existed at that point, right? And yeah. And it was a company where it was one CEO, one founder, and he has decided to start up a tech recruitment business. And I had no idea what tech, IT, or any of that means. But he just basically go, I think you've got a good vibe to do this recruitment thing. And I love that you're a blank canvas. And that has actually ingrained in my day-to-day now. Like I look for blank canvases so that I can draw on them, right? Mm. And so I think it all stemmed from the first time I landed into a company where the word startup didn't exist yet. And we were just trying to make things work. And I was doing, you know, any type of job possible other than just recruitment. And then obviously, like everyone else that was growing up, I did a couple of years of that. And then I realized I wanted a little bit more stability, went back into IBM and did my corporate time. And then when you've had the best of both worlds, you kind of realize, yeah, I actually prefer one over the other. That's when I kind of jumped back out and then have been in the startup space ever since.
Wow. Yeah, the startup space is absolutely exciting. And there's so much room to be able to work through formulas and to build relationships with people and to create, right? And you mentioned that again in your bio that a mentor entered your life at a point and really had an impact. At what point did the mentor enter your life and what kind of impact did that have?
I think this was a good maybe 5 years ago. And this was a CEO that I was working with. And truly, I felt that mentorship has definitely changed the way I look at people and culture. I had a lot of autonomy in the company, and exactly, you know, the perfect word that you have used to just describe a startup there is to be able to create. Mm-hmm. It's almost like it doesn't need to be something that has already been engineered and you have to take it on and you have to carve this linear path for every single person. And it has to be what has been proven. Please just, you know, pick it up and then drop it into another startup and do that. I know in a lot of ways people say, well, if you can white label most of the things, it's a lot more scalable. Yes, for sure, for efficiency. But if you think that you can white label every human practices and people practices, this is where you're really wrong. So for me, you know, there's a unique DNA to people practices. And even so far, I've worked for more than 15 startups by now in consulting and advisory. And never once I have been able to easily just duplicate a practice or a process applicable for another startup. Mm. It's not that easy.
Mm-mm. No. Yeah, no, I agree with that. And as I am actively a founder of a startup and I'm putting together what it looks like for the startup to be able to have an environment and a space that they can create in and they can enjoy mostly, I find that leadership without authority is something that's very interesting. And a good friend of mine wrote a book called Leadership Without Authority that I'm actually implementing now. And so that's what it is. It is the beginner's mind. It is the creative sort of alchemy within the company that really allows it to be able to be fast, be nimble, to be able to really understand where the disruption is, if there is disruption there, and to be able to capitalize on it and do that while you're having fun. I think that's an important part of not just a startup, but of life in general.
Correct.
It just is. And you know, when they say work-life balance, what I say to that is when you're at work, you're still in life. And when you're in life, you know, life is your work. It's whatever you do. If you're writing a book or whatever. So balance in life, I feel, is probably something that's key here. I want to get into your book because I love the name of your book, The Soul of Startups. That's amazing. I mean, that points at an organization having a heart, having a soul. What was it that inspired you to write this book?
Okay, long story cut short, which is the party line that I tell most people, is that the book actually, I started writing the book because I felt like there has been a lot of stories that's been going around. And through my experience as well, I kind of felt like I needed to do this as something that I call a therapy for myself. It's intentional reflection, and I needed to get it off my chest. And I just started journaling. And the more I journaled, I realized that, hey, there's a little bit of a story here. Maybe I can put something together. And then I started to test the waters by talking to different people out there. So I would tap, you know, the shoulders of my community, anybody. And one thing leads to another. People started connecting me with other people with similar stories. So all in all, the book started off as something that I felt was a little bit like my private diary that then turned into this voice of community. And the whole point of this book is really to create this platform for operators to be able to tell their stories. So there's one thing I made it very simple in the book, which is I would not ask a founder any of their opinion to put it in my book because they've got plenty of platforms to talk about their own companies, be it good or bad, right? Mm-hmm. But the platform for operators themselves is none. It's either, you know, you go through quite a legality route where it's like whistleblowing, if something terrible happens to you in a startup, right? Mm-hmm. But what about the people who have left kind of unscathed and have a great story to tell? Who are they going to tell it to? They may write a personal story on LinkedIn and then they get a couple of buzz likes. But what if we collate all of this and actually create some learning from this? And so what was really magnificent for me throughout this journey was that it's these people that were so willing to share their stories. They're like, oh, I finished the book already. Oh, but I still have some more stories to tell you. Well, maybe let me work on a second one. But in the meantime, let's celebrate, you know, the community that has been able to come together and share their story. So really, it's a platform for the operators because we've gone through the good and bad, but have we truly learned from it? That was the big question for me.
So the founders' personal experiences, stories of resilience, stories of creativity, all of that is what you found that really lit up the book. Is that right?
Exactly. And in the eyes of all the other operators, so people who have worked very closely with founders, people who have worked side by side with them that have seen how they've affected a company's successes and failures. And that was the most important kind of part, right? Because you don't really see it from that lens. And so, you know, it was kind of like me, I felt like I wanted to give everybody that voice for them to share their story.
What was it that, so prior to writing the book and now, what was your biggest like insight, right? That the aha that came out of all the different stories as you sort of read through there, any threads or insights?
Yeah. So there was the aha moment came when I was compiling and kind of writing that very final chapter, chapter 10, which I called the Black Diamond. And it's basically just collecting all the good of every other bits and bobs of all the behaviors into one perfect founder. But let's be honest, there's no one perfect like that, right? So the real understanding here was that it's a very, very difficult job. And so this book is also a tribute to founders that have been able to do amazing and great things. Even if they have failed, they've picked themselves up together. They have restarted their lives and new companies and have gone on journeys to do better and better each and every time. Because we forget to think that they're also human. They're on a journey themselves. They're trying to go through their own personal growth. You know, the things that you ask a company to supply to you, who are they asking for from? They have to figure this out themselves. So it's at the end, that very chapter was an aha moment for me where I go, I suddenly have this immense gratefulness towards incredible founders that I've worked with before, because I have seen them gone through this hard life and is still standing up great companies now.
Yeah. It sounds like you found a lot of resilience in those founders and you celebrated them after you went through all of those stories.
Exactly. It's really about celebrating them. And also I want to make it really clear that it's a very tough job. And most of the time they find it as one of the loneliest jobs, right? This is what got me into coaching as well. And I think we tend to forget that. Like there's this figure around founders having to absolutely be a superhero. But why are you expecting a 25-year-old founder doing this for the first time in their life to have all the answers to all your questions? It's bizarre. No. You wouldn't expect that from a friend, but so why would you expect it from a founder? Work with this person. Let's figure out the answers together, which is something that is, you know, quite rare nowadays.
Absolutely. And there really isn't too many forums available for founders to reflect on their journey and their hero's journey. And a lot of the times founders are so busy doing and creating and building and negotiating and, you know, dealing with the ups and downs that taking a step back and really appreciating what it is that they've learned, what they've gone through, and the stabilization that they build into the economy just by continuing to create is really something. Let's get back into culture, because I think, you know, founders and managers and, you know, alchemists that are listening to the show will get a lot of good information about what you're giving. So what's the biggest issue that founders face when they're wanting to build culture, or when they want to enhance a company culture or put something in?
Yeah, I think the main challenge that they usually come across is they don't know where to start. Let's be honest, right? Yeah. Nobody wakes up one day and decides that they're going to build a terrible company. That has never been. It's very aspirational, you know, highly ambitious individuals that decided, I don't only want to solve a world problem with the product that I'm creating. I also want to build great workplace for the people that are eventually going to work for me and be on this journey with me and make impactful material changes in the world. Highly, highly aspirational. And this is what I love about them. Mm-hmm. And then along the way, they realize, I've never done this before. Where do I even start? And so I think throughout my experience, you know, some of the main, very common, typical challenges are they're not finding the right ambassadors, or I love to call them culture guardians, for people like that, and work with people like that to build great cultures with. Because culture is a collective of different kind of behaviors from your employees. And so, you know, if a founder is kind of like a straight shooter, let's be honest. For example, there's an individual who's a founder and he or she may be a straight shooter and this is just the way they speak. For them, they want to cut through, you know, a lot of these weeds so that they can get straight to the point. They want to give you the right directions and they're fully transparent. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't necessarily translate into a good culture because we don't know how other people will react depending on the different audiences. So when you're able to kind of create a string of DNA based on transparency in your communication, but allow other people who may see or feel it differently to then take up their own version of transparency in their own conversation or communication, then you eventually end up with a transparent culture. So it's almost like you might be someone who's also really honest, but the way you speak might be slightly different and the way you deliver feedback will be very different from the way I am. We're not exactly the same. Right. But at the very least, you and I principally align on being completely honest and transparent with each other, as well as the people around us. So that's what culture really is. So the biggest challenge with founders is that they think that they have to do this themselves. They think that they're fully responsible for forming a culture that is incredible. But when you say amazing culture, what does that actually mean? It goes from A to Z. It's such a wide spectrum here. It's not a one size fits all. So for me, in my experience, I've always seen that the typical challenge is they don't know where to start and they think that they have to do this themselves.
What is a culture guardian? Like, describe how someone would find a culture guardian in their organization.
So a culture guardian is really someone who can translate behaviors into practices. So you should always have someone like that in the company where they kind of like becomes the gatekeeper or the person that course corrects any poor behaviors that are not ideal behaviors or desired behaviors. So a good example would be, say, it's an honest and transparent culture in the company. This is exactly what they kind of strive for, and they've been doing a lot of work. And suddenly there's a performance management framework that doesn't really kind of like allow the transparency and honesty of feedback loop. So a culture guardian is someone who really kind of goes, I'm very deeply connected to honesty and transparency as a principle in life. So how can I translate it into a process where I can create a safe environment for people to raise better feedback? Can I create a safer platform for people to share honest feedback with each other? So a culture guardian is really someone who I find incredibly valuable in a company, and it does not need to be a full-time job per se. It just needs to be someone who is deeply connected to what the culture needs to be and what they believe it is, and then they create best practices around it.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. So having someone be responsible for ensuring that the deep values and the culture of the company are being adhered to, but not in a way that is rigid, but in a way that maybe invites the company to take a shape that's a bit more transparent, that's a bit more steeped in what the founders and the creators of the organization intended to in terms of setting culture. Well, what if it's another situation? So there could be a founder, manager, someone who's not really sure whether they need to do anything about the company culture. Is there a litmus test, or is there some way that you can go into your company and say, okay, because, you know, I may be a founder, I think my culture is great, and when I leave the room, everyone's like, oh, and they want to find, you know, the next job immediately. So what's the litmus test I can put in place there?
Yeah. So the first thing you definitely want to feel is when the environment no longer feels enjoyable, both for you and your people. So, you know, exactly like what you say, you suddenly see maybe a flux, or you're starting to see that you have retention issues, but then you're sitting here thinking, I'm doing everything I can. I'm doing the best I can. And I think I'm a pretty good version of myself right now as a leader and a manager. So why is this happening? Yeah. And I think being very cognitive about the environment not being enjoyable anymore should be your true first sign that there is something to be done to improve something in your culture. Mm-hmm. So really, you know, as soon as it starts to feel less enjoyable, which isn't the intention when you create a company, right? You want to create this great environment with people you vibe, and there's, you know, this excitement that is contagious, and everybody just want to come together and solve a problem. That's the most rewarding part of being part of the startup world. Mm-hmm. As soon as it starts to feel a little bit off and not enjoyable anymore, that's the first answer you have and the first sign you have that something needs to be done.
What are some first steps to take to be able to start to improve things if you find that happening?
Yeah. So first things first, it's always people problems. it's a full circle. It always comes back to people. So, you know, you will see issues that are stemmed from conflict between different dynamics that just don't really get along. And, you know, the first thing that really needs to be done is just try and understand where this is coming from. Has there been a misalignment of goals that are creating, you know, this aftermath of people feeling highly stressed, and then stress will lead to fear and insecurity of losing their jobs, and then therefore productivity goes down. And then finally, at the end of the output is, why isn't my product being shipped on time?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That speaks to how company culture really just ripples out to the customers, the internal you know, everything in a company, investors, that all ripples out of the company culture, and the quality of the product or service really can be, the texture of it really can be felt on the other end of that. So what are the recommendations for leaders that are struggling around this? What if you're a leader and you can't seem to find the right culture guardian? I mean, what are some simple steps you can take to maybe leaders right now, or managers who are listening to this, or both, the combined, who are thinking, I don't know how to how to do this? Is there an exercise I need to put in? Maybe it's more pizza every week.
That's usually one way to bring people together. I would never say to that. The easiest thing for founders to really start doing is just start opening up and just start talking about it, right? The problems that you have in your company are not exclusive to yourself.
Right.
This is exactly what we were talking about earlier. It's creating that platform to start the conversation. That's the most important first part. It's reaching out to your peers, your community, no matter how small they are, and really share the problems that you're facing. And I think it's also really important to emphasize that founders don't need to think that they have to do this on their own. Plus, to be perfectly honest with you, if you're not cognitive about the environment, the problems, and where the root cause is, it's almost impossible for you to notice a culture garden, even if that person is right under your nose, because you wouldn't know what kind of directions to give anyway, right? So it's almost like you want to start working on clearer communication and do a bit of deep dive and understand where the little conflicts are coming up from. What are the reasons for this conflict? What are the reasons people are not as happy as they used to be? So ask these questions. And I think as a founder, especially, it's absolutely your prerogative to go and ask these questions, because it's your dear, dear, dear company, right? You've set on a path to create a great work environment. So make it your accountability to find out why this is happening. Now, on the other hand, if it does come down to having the finger pointing back at you that you are the problem, then start acknowledging it. Don't brush it off. Don't find someone else to solve the problem for you. And this is another mistake that a lot of founders tend to do is, yeah, I've got a problem. Maybe I'm the problem. I get it. I'm going to find a chief culture officer or a chief people officer to come in and fix that problem for me. The moment you think that you're going to farm this thing out to other people to fix, this is where you're making the biggest mistake. Because again, like I said earlier, it needs to be in tandem. How can I fix a culture for a company that does not belong to me? Nor did I start this in my bedroom, for example.
That's exactly right. Wow. That is so, look, just to hear that, the first thing to do when you sense that there's a lack of enjoyment is to address it in a platform where it's transparent and open. And not all founders can necessarily create that right away, but it's a very natural thing to do, to be able to give people a forum where they can speak into it and be able to, you know, just that alone, just a leader going to the team and saying, I don't have all the answers, right? And I'm sensing that people aren't enjoying the work as much as they did. Let's create a forum where we can all kind of speak into this forum and discuss how we can make this better. Does that sound like a simple way to begin the process of what you're describing?
Absolutely. And don't forget also, every time you make an effort to do something different, you are going to get an answer, whether it's the answer you like or not. For example, you will create this, say, anonymous platform, super safe for people to leave feedback. If you get zero feedback to come back or not in the number that you desire, especially when you've got more people in the company, your first tell sign is there a fear culture here that people are even afraid of leaving anonymous feedback? That's the first problem. No matter what, the moment you put in the effort to find out the reason, you are going to get an answer. And so the thing to do is actually just to start.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. And don't take it personally. You know, it's a step in the right direction when you discover something that may be in the blind spot, right? And now you can bring that into the forefront. Wow, that's excellent. That's such good advice that you're giving here, Sophie. I have a couple of last questions for you. One of them is, what lights you up? Like what really lights you up right now? Now that you've written a book, now that you've been in the, you know, in the Fortune 100 world, you've been in the startup world. Share that with me.
I love to keep the conversation going. I really, really feel like I have taken on this sense of accountability to create the platform for operators. And I really think that founders, entrepreneurs have plenty, plenty, more than enough, dare I say, platform to speak their version of the story. But I think the only way we can all be accountable and build great businesses together in this ecosystem is we actually learn from hearing about the experiences from the other people. that have lived and breathed our journey. They may feel very differently. And that's kind of like a smack in reality for you. And you kind of go, I thought I've built a pretty good company. I didn't know that this was actually happening to one of my employees. Automatically, I feel like you're just going to become a better manager, leader the next time by just getting that feedback. And I think this is ultimately the feedback loop that is missing in this ecosystem. So I would love to continue the conversation, raise as many bars as possible, and just get to a place where, you know, because I love what I do and I go into work with such enjoyment, and I know not everybody feels that way. But how can we, you know, make this even more common for people to actually truly enjoy the work that they do?
Yeah. Well, it's clear that you enjoy this. I can see that it lights you up as you go through and talk about it. And you've truly given a voice to startup founders, and you've given them a platform where they could share not only the technicalities of founding a business and succeeding in business, but also a platform where they can work through the nuance and the culture and the enjoyment and the deep the need and longing for expansion and creativity that we all have, that founders really put out there. So thank you so much for doing that. Thank you for writing this book. What's next for Sophie?
I don't know. I mean, I have more and more stories coming to me. Maybe a second book. I really don't know. Maybe I can take the pace a little bit and test more of these theories out. But I definitely want to continue to work with startups. The smaller, the better. I've kind of like gone back in reverse right now, where I'm so interested and excited about companies that are very small that are approaching me, because, you know, it's such a rewarding feeling knowing that we're getting people to be so much more aware of the problem right now, and they want to fix it and put great foundations in. Whereas for most of my career, I've been going into places that should have already fixed that problem like 5 years ago. I'm a little bit too late now, right? Yeah. And so my day-to-day became just putting out fires. And it's so rewarding and refreshing right now that there's so much awareness out there that culture is so important for companies. It's the foundation. It's the very soul of great businesses. And so therefore, like, these small companies gets me so excited. They're like, you know, 8 people, but we want to build a great culture. I go, perfect. This is exactly the kind of conversation I want to be having.
Yeah. I'm going to be talking to you about this in my company, because I honestly love what you're putting out there. I see the shift across the world in not just companies, but in people themselves, really working on what really matters in companies and really cultivating enjoyment and cultivating creativity and working towards something that's not always just capitalism and profits driven, right? Working towards like a true nourishment that's fulfilling people's lives. So thank you so much for what you're doing. If anybody's interested in the book, it's called The Soul of Startups. How does somebody get in contact with you, Sophie?
I'm always on LinkedIn, on Twitter. Yeah. It's my first name, last name, but easily get me on www.sophietheen.com.
That's simple. It. Wonderful. And you can find a link to Sophie Thien's website in our bio. You can also go to sophietheen.com. Check out The Soul of Startups. It is an amazing new way to look at startups and organizations in general. Thank you so much for your time on the show. And I'm serious about this, Sophie. I'm going to be contacting you about my startup, because the ideas and what you're bringing in are fundamental. They're foundation fixing. So
perfect. I'm happy.
Absolutely. I appreciate your time in the Alchemist Lounge today. Thank you for sharing the alchemy behind startups, and continued success onward and upward.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Bye, Sophie.
Bye.
Thanks for listening in to the Alchemist Lounge. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review on Apple iTunes. To catch all the latest from Alex Atwood, you can check out his website at alexatwood.co. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next time at the Alchemist Lounge.